All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome back to the Beit Midrash for Talmud class. I want to make a hakdashah tonight. We want to really dedicate our learning tonight to a refuah shlema, for a refuah shlema to Luisa Paulino, who is our bookkeeper in our community, who just had a terrible, terrible episode and is in critical condition in Lincoln Medical Center up in the Bronx. We really pray for her body to find deep strength and for her soul to have comfort and for her family to find the inspiration they need. It's that critical. So we really do pray and want to dedicate our learning to her. She brings a spirit to our community, welcoming through the work she does in the office and being our bookkeeper and being familiar with all our congregants as they are here a long while or just getting to know the community and learns a little bit more of the Shabbat spirit all the times, wishing everybody Shabbat Shalom, and asks me consistently about all the holidays and what their messages are. And, you know, it's just a Bisharecha. You know, she's in our gates. She's come through our gates and really over the years gotten very connected here. And her connection here is important to us, and our connection to her as she's ill and she needs our prayers is deep and real and serious. So we dedicated our learning tonight in her honor for refuah shlema, for strength for the family, inspiration for them. So I want to start with a little bit more of biblical and Talmudic medicine, because it's worth our taking a look. Yeah, it was when we started. I had already started. Yeah. So I want to start. I want to open up to page 84B and Yoma with two asterisks, probably. 84B. And just before we launch into search, rescue, who do we save, and how do we tell who we save, and all of the matters that are going to get us into that part of the Mishnah, I want to take a look at a passage on, really it's the end of 84A, I'm sorry, so just turn back one page to 84A3. And I'm going to kind of get us into the middle of a conversation just to mention a few of the different kinds of medical approaches they're taking to someone who's ill and who needs some treatment. And remember, we're in the middle of discussions about whether or not we permit these types of, well, you could call them solutions, you could call them treatments, you could call them folk remedies on Shabbat. So we basically have seen so far that we came up with all kinds of ways to allow for whatever type of remedy, whatever type of medication, whatever type of treatment we know is available. Yet we had discussions halakhically about how to get there because we're concerned that we live within the framework of halakha, within the dalet amot shel halakha, within the four pillars of the law. This guides us on our path. We want to know, even though it might seem like pshita, as the Gemara says. Simply put, we're going to treat this person, are we not? But we want to know through the halachic approach whether or not we're violating anything else, because it might change our behavior a little way. And last week I told you the story of Shuli being cut and injured on Shabbat and everybody making plans enough to get her all the treatment she needed and also to be Sabbath observant in the move over to the hospital, right? So all that in mind, I wanted to just look at this one spot, and I'm going to go where the Gemara rejects a proof on 84A3 on the left-hand side. Low! The Gemara puts up the low. No, it's not the case. What's not the case? It's not necessarily what the sages mean. Lema'ute makizin dam lisoronchi. Perhaps they mean to exclude only the remedy of letting blood to heal quinsy. Note 35. Rashi as rendered by Targum Haloetz. So, if you look at the word seronchi, and then you go over and you look at the Rashi, lo lema'ute makizin dam lisarchuni b'shabbat leolam ochale achule hanach plige umay be'elu mishum de shemuahal rabbi matya de amar akati achariti. And then it says lisarunchi choli sheshemo. It's a sickness, and its name is Ashtarneglin Hu. Right? Do you see this? Bun Malnet Uvahahi Modele. So, in our Rashi, it's called, a sickness that's called Ashtarnaglin, or Ashtarnaglovin. And it really doesn't have this word, quinsy. And I think that the note is not exactly matching up with the Rashi commentary that we have. We have a different name. That Rashi brought here. But that's to say that all these illnesses in the Gemara are somewhat, kind of like mystery names until you locate exactly which one you're really talking about from this tradition or that language. Steinfeld does not have the same translation that we just read. He uses the word sarunchi in italics. So listen to how he says it. It excludes a different remedy, which Rabbi Matya suggests, bloodletting, to heal the ailment sarunchi. So maybe the name sarunchi, by way of quinsy, in some manuscript of Rashi's old French commentary was around. All right, but we didn't have that. We had Ishtarnaglevin or Ishtarnaglin. And Sarunchi here, though, to Steinsaltz, does get its own definition. So we'll go over to the language section of Steinsaltz's edition. Sarunchi, this apparently refers to diphtheria, as it seems to be derived from an Aramaic word meaning strangling. In cases of diphtheria, the saliva that fills the ill person's throat can lead to suffocation. Okay, so
just as I looked up the word quinsy,
yeah.
This translator used the word quinsy, and it looks like it's an inflammation around the tonsil, so like tonsillectomy would be closest, I think.
Right, so I was just going there.
Okay.
So what is, then, quinsy? It's this throat disease. And in the ancient world, I don't know that they knew exactly that it was caused by inflammation, per se. I don't know that they knew the exact word. But it's some type of throat disease that basically chokes you. And so it would make sense that they took this throat disease notion or this diphtheria. And what did they know about diphtheria in the ancient world? And so we'll turn back to Biblical and Talmudic Medicine by Proust. And the entry for diphtheria includes not only our word sarunki or sarunchi, it includes a word askara. And it'll start out with a little bit more of a mythological reality about a sickness than a scientific one. So here we go. Ankar askara, when you look up diphtheria, this is where the index takes you. Askara is a punishment for slandering. Just like slander, askara begins in the insides of the body and ends last in the mouth. It affects primarily children, often in night attacks. Adults are also afflicted, as were the scouts in the wanderings of the Jews in the desert and the large number of disciples of Rabbi Akiva who were killed in an epidemic between Passover and Shavuot, which is why we have the mourning period in the first part of this counting of the Omer, remember? Because really it was Rabbi Akiva's students who would not respect one another, couldn't speak nicely to each other, and that whole time during our calendar is a time, a mournful time, because of this notion. Whereas ordinarily the trumpets are sounded, as mentioned above, to announce the outbreak of an epidemic after three deaths have occurred therefrom, Ascara is an illness that was so feared that even after one death, the above measure of blowing the trumpets is implemented. Death occurs by asphyxiation. It is hard, it's the hardest death of the 903 types of death that exist. Death by Ascara is like tearing out the threads of wool from thorns that lie under ferns, or like forcing a ship's cable through a narrow hole in the mast. This is how difficult the death throes are, and with what difficulty the soul leaves the body. He who eats lentils once a month and uses salt on every solid food and adds water to every beverage keeps Ascara away from his house, according to Talmud Brachot. It's likely that the illness known as Sirunki or Sirvanki, which is ours, is similar to the sickness Ascara. Rabbi Joseph said that although the Sanhedrin is no longer in existence and capital punishment cannot be decreed by Jewish courts, the four forms of capital punishment still exist, and he who would have been sentenced to strangulation is either drowned in the river or dies of Sirunki. So you had this kind of, right, this kind of sin equals punishment thinking a little bit deeper in the Middle Ages in terms of liturgy than at this point. But you have, of course, the notion of Yom Kippur liturgy that comes and talks about sin leading to real results. You know, if there's anything to it, right, it's that some people sin and some have a guilty conscience. And you would imagine that they knew something of stress. If you want to talk physiologically and some of the beginnings of thinking about if there were physiological considerations given to the whole notion of how sin and death play out, what it seems like a sinful person is sentenced to, of course you deal with the theological problem of the same person who's not a sinner and the same person who doesn't deserve it because of any behavioral kind of... Or even if you think that every person deserves tshuva and deserves a chance to repent, and therefore how could a just and good God deliver such sickness upon someone who has potential clean slate to make on Yom Kippur? We have it year to year, right? So all this comes into play when you hear a statement like that. Rabbi Joseph says, following more, Rabbi Yishmael says, it's the opinion that immediate bloodletting is indicated in this illness. And there is where you have this prescription for bloodletting and the debate in our Gemara about whether or not we're talking about not allowing for this bloodletting, particularly for this, and maybe that's a disagreement with what Rabbi Ishmael ben Rabbi Yossi is really prescribing for this kind of a sickness. And so where they might have a little bit of a problem with letting something happen on a Shabbat is where maybe either there's a disagreement with someone's opinion or there's experience with someone's prescription vis-a-vis that ailment that they've identified and they don't want it to happen on the Sabbath, right? It's a very, very small number of particular types of treatments or remedies that I want to limit in the greater context of the halachic principle that's at work in our part of the Gemara, which is being taught to us. And again, remembering it's about being taught to us on Yom Kippur, but right now I don't need to remember exactly that I'm talking only about Yom Kippur. I'm talking about all of Shabbat and all of the times when it seems like there are strict laws that keep you from wanting to break the very, very legal structures, all of the kind of strictures of Shabbat. I can break it based on the halachic principle of sfeik nifashot lahakel. Not pikuach nefesh tochet ha-Shabbat, even. Pikuach nefesh dochet haShabbat, saving a life, makes me set aside all Shabbos regulations. That's one way to say it. But I can go towards the more lenient opinion that says, Sfeik nefashot lakel, if there's any chance that I'm going to save this person, I'm going to take and break the law. The reason why I have both at work, though, I could really say we're under the banner of both those kinds of halachic principles, is that I want at least two halachic principles to drive home the fact that there will be some, and we're going to see this in our Gemara today, who, you know, try to rearrange what's doing right now and what needs to happen in terms of treatment based on feeling like they do have a responsibility to Sabbath laws, and they don't want to break the Sabbath law. And we're not even talking about breaking it willy-nilly, right? We're just talking about breaking it. And they would like not to have to go that direction. So the rabbis have created at least two different conceptions about how you can justify any breakage of the law you need to break. And yet in the Gemara, we are experiencing a little bit of a discussion about what we ought not to do, because perhaps there was some kind of knowledge that it really didn't do the job. And the reason why I'm concluding that maybe it was against this one sage's opinion that bloodletting was a good thing, because it's named as a single sage who held this opinion, and there was no further discussion about an expert who knew that this was the right thing or what have you. It was just that this kind of thing. But that sage is included here, so listen. And this explanation of the sage's view is indeed reasonable. Hachinami mistabra, for it was taught in another braita, Titania shlosha devarim amar Rabbi Yishmael ba Rabbi Yossi sheshama mishum Rabbi Matya ben Charash. Rabbi Yishmael, the son of Rabbi Yossi, said three things that he heard in the name of Rabbi Matya ben Charash. Makiz hindam l'sarunchi b'shabbat, we let blood for quincy on the Sabbath, or for diphtheria, or askara. Machilin oto mechatzar hakavid shelo, we feed him from its, Umishe nishacho kelev shote, and one who was bitten by a mad dog, ken machilin oto mechatzar kavid shelo, we feed him from his liver. Remember, we saw some doubt about that last week, right? Did we not do that because it seemed like too folksy a thing? V'choshesh b'fiv, and one who feels pain in his mouth, mitilin lo sam b'shabbat. We put medicine in his mouth for him on the Sabbath. V'chachamim omrim, be'elu en behen mishum refuah. These have no therapeutical value, though. Like in our experience, I'm not really talking about them having any great possibility to help save the day here. Take away the pain, or to solve the problem, or to heal the sickness. So, be'elu lema'ute mai, but when the sages say these have no therapeutic value, what do they mean? To really exclude? My love atarate batarate le'ulema'ute deresha. Are they not referring to the last two remedies, and they mean to exclude the first remedy, meaning the bloodletting? That is, they hold the last two remedies, including the medicine for one who feels pain in his mouth, have no therapeutic value, but they agree that the first remedy, letting blood to heal quincy, is effective. Ah, so maybe what they mean is no, they want to permit the first one and just limit the second two. Gemara counters, lo, that's not the case. Atarte deresha kaimayata lema'ute desefa. Perhaps they refer to the first two remedies and intend to exclude the last one, which I was already on because I knew it was coming in the Gemara. So, ultimately, when you have a discussion about these kinds of treatments, you might have one or another that the sages feel as though it wasn't really effective and therefore I could limit it. And just before we, again, before we move into a little reaction and conversation, I want to tell you that it mentioned putting sam, which is the word for medication or drug, in somebody's mouth on Shabbat, and it mentioned the liver lobe, and it mentioned bloodletting. So let's at least take a look at a couple of these entries here. So first of all, just by way of sam and putting it in your mouth, putting a drug in the mouth on Shabbat, okay? Sometimes the drugs were pulverized and then taken internally, either as the dry powder or suspended in water. In this manner, the samadinastha, an abortifacient remedy, was imbibed. So too did Rabbi Chiya advise his sons, drink no sama, for an abscess of the mouth, the remedy was blown in with a blade of a straw. So they obviously had kind of different methodologies of application. Maybe it did something topically, if you did it that way, instead of being just washed right down into the digestive system. A powder of that type was called sam, and an Aramaic sama. So there's a little bit of a kind of difference between drinking down a medication versus this kind of powder form that's blown into your mouth. And that's what we're talking about. Pulverizing it would be the malach on Shabbat. We wouldn't necessarily allow that just any time. But if someone needs it, you could pulverize it. And two, you could apply that in such a way, whether it was drink or blowing it in this methodology. It can either be a powder of life, sam chayim. We call it a powder of life, a sam chayim, which is healing remedy, or a powder of death, sam mita or sam mavet. Or sam hamavet, which is a poison. In post-Talmudic usage, the term sam, without addition of prefix or suffix, is mostly used in the latter sense. The reason is that in the Mishnah, the term sam also refers to a writing material, which is thought to be orpiment, which is arsenic sulfide. There is nothing in the word sam to indicate its true meaning and derivation. Also, in the cuneiform tablets, the word sam is used in the broad sense. So what's fascinating, just to think about it, I don't know what, before I looked at this the first time, what I was really thinking about when it said medicine in the Talmud. But try to, now that I've given it to you, my question to you should have been before I read the paragraph. What do you think about in terms of your own, quote-unquote, being anchored to the text when it said they give him a medicine in his mouth? Well, we already established this mortar and pestle, right? So that would have been some type of crushed stuff. How did you think they actually applied it? You know, did you think about it in terms of mixing it into some water? Did you think about it in terms of actually putting the powder itself in the mouth? That, you know, because imagine like inside of a medication, it seems really strange to actually just put the powder in. But they're talking about it being a sam, being a powder. And with that one explanation of application, blown in through the straw.
And that's the type of medication that's still used today. Inhaled powders for treatment of asthma.
That's and very so true. We have inhalers.
And the whole idea of it wasn't just like put a spoonful in. You were blowing it in. And so that makes me think in terms of this may well be something that was intended to be blown in.
Like this asthma inhaler.
Exactly.
Wow.
There are inhalers today that have powder inside them. That there's a chamber, and you know.
Wow.
Well, one goes to your trachea, and the other goes down to your esophagus.
Yeah. Uh-huh, and naturally the body will accept it into the trachea in the right way.
You got me, I don't know.
But usually you don't want to put a solid in the trachea. But administration of the drug depends on the stability of the drug and where you want to deliver it to.
Bobby needs you to speak a little louder, Charlie.
Oh. Administration of the drug depends on how the drug is stable.
Mm-hmm.
You want to keep the drug stable, and what your target organ or what your target tissue is.
Right.
So asthma, you want to put it into the respiratory system. You want to decrease inflammation in the respiratory system.
Mm-hmm.
And so you blow it in, but they're blowing it in. When the person blows it in there, they do... this too, because they're not swallowing it, they're breathing it.
Yeah.
So and you want it sort of like vaporized, like a vapor.
Right. So maybe they already knew from what needed to happen by when they didn't have these pumps were basically.
Well, those pumps too are also those have liquids in them.
Some.
But there also are devices.
Yeah, that you just.
Like
that you breathe in, right?
Yeah.
Right. Very good.
Something in the mouth. Aren't we talking about something in the mouth?
We were talking about something in the mouth, something in the throat.
In the throat.
And I imagine they're also talking about something in the respiratory system.
The lungs,
as
you know, that's
but I imagine they're talking about getting to the respiratory system.
There's an inverse issue here, which I think is interesting, which is that you're allowed to use ineffective remedies when it's not
Yeah.
The fact that it's an ineffective remedy doesn't seem to bother anybody.
If that's at all pertinent to the debate. I'm suggesting that because I saw a couple of times that these are kind of names of sages who were talking about medical and health-related kinds of pieces of advice or prescriptions, and I'm thinking that they knew from the language of our Mishnah that there were experts, right? And I hope that they were humble enough to know when they needed to turn to those experts versus kind of an inherited saying that Rabbi Yossi said. Now, they're saying Rabbi Yossi said it. You can trust Rabbi Yossi, who hopefully said it because he's had some experience with these things. But Rabbi Yossi shouldn't be the last word on it, right? And I think this Mishnah made a move towards going outside your sage's network to figure out whether or not a person needs to eat on Yom Kippur. That's part of the radical nature of this Mishnah itself, right? That they know when to step back. It's kind of still used, by the way, in rabbinical training. You may have a vocabulary because you have often seen X or Y psychological situation. You may have a vocabulary with this because you have some typical exposure, routine exposure to typical medical ailments, right? But never put yourself in the spot of a doctor. Right. Very important, the distinction. I think the Mishnah begins to set up that conversation. How much will you, you know, quote-unquote, be there to suggest that people get the advice in the right place, or how much will you say, well, I've heard so-and-so say this is the way to be, you know, to administer a treatment. And by the way, that happens in hospital settings with social workers, pastoral care folks, chaplains, docs, nurses have their own set of conversations around those issues.
I also found it very interesting, and an evidence of the kind of compassion that they were trying to show, that there's no distinction made that I can see between a treatment that's intended to fix the problem and one that's intended to make you feel better.
Mm.
You know, simply relieving the pain, even if it does nothing for the underlying disease, seems to be okay.
Yeah, that's a nice point, because palliative care, when something's really hurting you, if they can find a way to do it, they will absolutely allow you to take a pain medication and not suffer through it. So palliation in that sense, whether it's for long term to make you more comfortable over the course of death.
And that's not the kuach
nefesh. Right. And that's
not saving
anybody. That's really not. Though it is potentially leading you to better health in the longer run because of the lessening of the pain and the stress that goes along. That seems to be stitched in. And we could probably find several more examples to prove your point.
It's very interesting in this chapter that we are talking about refuah, that the influence of the non-Jewish surrounding is greatly shown here, because they allow them to have non-kosher food, and they allow them to do akazat dam on Shabbat, which is al tashchit. It's against our Jewish concept of al tashchit. And we are doing a medical procedure that is against our Jewish concept of life. It's very interesting that all the methodologies that they are using here are not even Jewish.
Well, let's read about the blood letter for a second. See if it's quote-unquote against. Your point is well taken. By way of this piece of the perek, the encounter with the non-Jewish world is really apparent, right? And we even said, even on Yom Kippur, right? And that's just really fascinating to me. It's fascinating that there was enough of a scent of the odorizing, the barbecue going on with the pot roast in the oven from the neighbor, where there could be any of that kind of tava, any of that kind of desire of the woman to eat a little something. Blood letter. Let's go back this way. Page 33 is towards the beginning. No, you're not turning. I have it in Peros's Biblical and Talmudic. Whereas the physician in Judaism is considered to be a scholar, a chakim, the blood letter, as his Talmudic name, Uman or Umana, connotes, is an artisan. Sometimes he's also called gara, which is exactly what the late Latin expression minutor connotes. Latin gara is minuens sanguinum. This in Syriac, minuens barbam, the cutter or barber. To consider that uman refers to the Greek aimon, which means shedder of blood, murderer, is sheer nonsense. Ovadia of Bartonoro, the famous Mishnah commentator, also mentions the interpretation of blacksmith, somehow an artisan. Other than his function as a bloodletter, the uman was also sometimes referred to as a circumciser. He had no other occupation. As already proven earlier, the surgeon throughout Talmudic times was only the rofe. So what is the rofe in ancient times? He's the surgeon. What kind of surgery do I have in the ancient world?
Amputation.
Amputation?
Done usually by the barber. They were the most experienced with razors.
Who?
The barber.
Many, many times, a barber, and that's why you have uman as being named barber here, in addition to the workman or craftsman, who's also a blacksmith. So it's not only barbers, but it's barbers, blacksmiths, and those who work with tools for creating the plows and whatever kind of iron implements. And if you have someone who's a weapons maker, remember, because there's a whole halacha about weapon making, weapon selling, that we have to, quote unquote, contend with, I say these days, in our tradition.
That's blades.
All kinds.
But they were in the same guild also in the Middle Ages.
In the Middle Ages.
The barber guild. And
yeah. So the Fay is someone who knows how to use all those, but the functions of, and this the next sentence, the functions of the barber were served by the sapar. This seems to be undoubtedly evident from the combination or juxtaposition of the two designations, umana and sapar. Jost and others assert that the barber also served as bloodletter, but they overlook the fact that their authority, like Maimonides, explicitly speaks of cupping of this in his time. Even in documents from the Middle Ages, the minutor is differentiated from the razor and also from the shirur geishkus. Although occasionally it happened in a cloister that a monk would execute all three functions simultaneously. Even the physician did not perform bloodletting, is the point. And the Persian physician, even today, considers this operation to be below his dignity. That's taken from a 1903 article. We have already spoken about the rofe uman. This expression does not refer to the medicus venum secans, or the surgeon who performs the most difficult type of surgery, as opposed to the barber surgeon, as Kozelman claims. The velar uman is a skillful writer, as opposed to a calligraphist. Even the professional wood gatherer is called uman. So, going forward. The Talmud expressly describes the merit of a bloodletter named Abba. And in so doing, in Tani, seems to give a positive valence to this approach to treating ailments, who not only had separate rooms for men and women, but who also insisted that women wear a special garment he had, which was slit at the shoulder, so that only the site of bloodletting was exposed. So you have ethics that are combined with the treatments that are going on. Outside of his consultation room, he had a special place, a box into which the patients deposited the fees he would charge. Those who could not afford to put their fees there, and those who could not pay, were not put to shame. If a scholar consulted him, he would not accept a fee from him. And if he saw after the bloodletting that a person was poor, he would give him some money and say, go strengthen yourself. So this bloodletting, in addition to the ethical practices of this other gentleman, really combine to give the valence, which we thought, and Ron, I would have said to you at first, that's exactly how the attitude is, that it's Thor and Mishalahem from them and not ours. But it seems that we have a few places and some attitude towards this bloodletting that brought it into dialogue with possibility of the way we deal with it as Jews.
Is there anything known at any time when this started?
About bloodletting?
Yeah. So this goes back to Galen, and which is the non-Jewish. I mean, this is the Greek-Roman world, and it all has to do with the balance of the humors, the four humors, and that goes all the way into the Middle Ages and all the way to Vesalius, and which is, you know, like 1400s or something. So until then, it is all this balance, and the bloodletting is to let go of certain things that were imbalancing your whole system. And, you know, there was the bile, and there was the choleric, you know, there were four of them.
Sanguine
is the blood. And they corresponded with the four seasons. I mean, it was this whole kind of trying to get a whole world view of putting things in order, both the world in order and the body in order. So it was the prevalent idea of health and science at the time was this Galenic thing. And it goes back to Galen. So whenever he is, I'd have to look him up exactly. But it just, you know, dominated the conception of the body and the fluids of the body. Phlegm was another one. And so that's what part of this whole, you know, letting the blood out. And it was all over the Western world.
That's to say that we are in dialogue when it comes to medical reality with the rest of the world and allow for it. And allow for it on the Sabbath. And back to the particular point of departure. And allow for it on Yom Kippur. And make sure that we have this really embedded in the culture of our most essential days between our Masechta and Yoma and then the parallels that we see in Masechet Shabbat. So there's just a wonderful notion of the humanity in it all. And then, that's to set us up for the fact that while there's wonderful humanity in it all, you're going to now get some dialogue about all of the rubble that falls on people's head, and now and then, you can kind of tell me whether or not it's as full of humanity as we might have hoped for. And for what reason we might not have extended ourselves to anyone and everyone all the time, and whether or not you agree that they are really, though, pushing, like with the medical discussion, to include as much as possible in terms of a response on the search and rescue front, as much as possible to go and save life. Okay. Other thoughts before we move on to the next parts of the Gemara?
But the construction, at least in English, you know, it begins ! But then the next...
I began there, but it really didn't begin that way. It began with a discussion of what we allow and what we don't allow, and I just brought us into the middle of the...
But the particular line...
Yeah.
!
Right.
But then the next sentence is, not necessarily. Which seems a lot weaker than !
Well, isn't that how Jews talk?
And then the next like, one is perhaps.
There's no way I would allow that on Shabbos. Well, of course, if he was really saying he was in pain and we got a doctor to say that indeed there was an issue, oh, of course I could allow it then. Right.
Okay.
So what you're hearing in that is exactly that. It's, what do you call this type of, let's say, this is the peel pool of the Talmud. It's the back and forth nature, but it's also the essential sense of, yeah, it's the type of hermeneutics, which means an argumentation style and not only a derivation style out of text. It's the notion that you could be 110% confident that you're right now. And you notice sometimes even when I'll present in English, I'll say it as if that's the point where we are. So there's absolutely no possibility that we're going to clear this pile of rubble over this group. Oh, but the next line says, well, maybe that isn't so, as you're noting. Mm-hmm. And that's a feature of Talmudic literature. It's an absolute feature of Talmudic.
But actually, in some things we read, that it was not always taking such an emphatic
decision. It doesn't.
Sometimes it's more like,
that's a good word for it. That's a good word for it. So you won't have all of the idiomatic translations capture the emphatic nature of the discussion, or sometimes the English discussion does catch the fact that it's not so emphatic, and what you have is the editorial nature of the Talmud definitely includes both. And on that level, the kind of discourse that's created by the rabbis, we have to ask sometimes, why does it become so emphatic? Is it because what's going on? There could be any number of reasons for emphatic no's and emphatic rejections. One is because they really have a braita, which is a text from the Tanaitic age, that goes completely against what's being offered as the approach, right? And they want that Tanaitic text to ascend to its proper place. Another reason might be more sociological. The sages of Babylonia want to tell you explicitly that there's no one in Eretz Yisrael, no one in Israel has anything up on us. Right? So they'll emphatically reject this guy's position because he comes from Israel. And we're here in Babylonia, in the capital of Talmudic learning. Or another might be that they have a verse that someone's using in a drush, in a way of understanding something, that makes total sense by way of our hermeneutical principles, but they need that verse because of the serious nature of taking from the Torah and having a canon of learning out of and from the Torah. They want to say that verse is not possibly applicable to your position here. We need that for a different matter. And sometimes that's just rabbinic playfulness to say that the verse could be this or that, and sometimes it's pushing against those who want to take the verse and go that direction because really there's a whole different school of thought regarding this particular verse and what the Torah is really trying to tell us. Those are probably some of the first kind of motivations that we could discuss in the kind of Talmudic parlance that you're noticing.
The only thing that I note is that they're only talking about one disease. And I'm just wondering whether that's... They're using that as the basis for making this further discussion that I would guess we're about to get into, or more general principles, or do they really mean to apply it only to this one?
Oh, so first of all, we're going to get into a topic that's not about disease. And so from the fact that they were discussing this sick person who might need to eat on Yom Kippur, whose life might need to be saved, whether it's Yom Kippur or Shabbat or Yontif for that matter, they mean to talk about, I think, particulars when it comes to some questions that might have been around vis-a-vis these particular diseases. But they mean to teach you the principles and put into action the two more, let's say, umbrella principles of how you can relate to Sabbath regulations, and they are the two principles, pikuach nefesh dochet ha-shabbat, saving a life means that I can set aside Shabbat laws and regulations, and two, safek nefashot la'akel, and that is, if there's any doubt in your mind regarding withholding treatment, or said positively, if there's any chance you can save this person on a Sabbath or Yontif or Yom Kippur, you go for it.
So this is just the example they use to get into that discussion.
I think that under the foundation of this discussion are those two meta principles. The specifics might be because there were some questions about some specific instances or sicknesses or ailments, and people had some questions. So far, by the way, we didn't disallow any of them because, remember, we just ended with the kind of Talmudic end game that sounds really, really very Talmudic. Like, maybe they brought that learning to say that the first two were not okay and the last one was okay. Or maybe the last one was okay and the first two weren't. And so we didn't get any real resolution, right? There wasn't a halakha is like this. the law stands like this. Very rarely does the Gemara say the law is like this. And what do you do with an open question like that? Well, you look to the authority in your day, and you look to the sources that tried to figure out whether or not we're going to go with it this way or we're going to go with it that way. And most people...
go to Shulchan Aruch.
Ravad, for instance, before Shulchan Aruch, you know, some of these people, they are generous with allowing everything because they apply the meta principle that we discussed, or the meta principles.
Just one little note. They talk about some things about treatments that have no effect, but I think of two things, one of which is the placebo effect, which now at this point is real, where if you...
That is a benefit.
Yes. So I look at this rabies. So you eat the dog's liver, okay? At this point, I think we know that that really is not going to have any real effect. But if you believe it's going to have an effect, and this is what you have to do, you know, that's exactly what it is. You've taken something, you believe it.
Right.
And something we were talking about also, just prayer also has some effect. If you pray as well, or just if you're doing something that you believe is in your part of your religion and doing things, well, that have a it does have a beneficial effect.
Right.
So how does that get in versus really no effect, or this is what you're supposed to do, and so that's what you should do.
Yeah, and I imagine that because of the fake nefashot lakel, that I am very lenient when it comes to allowing people to break Shabbat laws, Yom Kippur laws, I imagine that we could take pieces of what we learned so far and see that if we can just get her mind at ease and give her a little of this, even give her a little of the trace from the non-Jewish cooking going on next door, it's better. It's better, and it's important. And it's for good health. And so whether or not that was an actual fix of some structural reality is some medical reality, it does the job, and we allow for that.
It's interesting, though, that they have a difference of opinion as to whether or not these things have any effect, because we still don't know. I mean, today, a lot of studies are to find out whether or not something really is effective.
Mm.
There's all kinds of surprises, things that you thought were effective or not, other things that didn't seem to have much effect. We're now doing really, I forget what they're called, data-based or whatever, fact-based studies on it. So I think it's actually kind of interesting that they had disagreement as to the effectiveness of things. We're still having disagreements as to
as long as it's chicken soup, everything is okay.
No, that's a good point, Bobby, because...
the effect, but we still don't know now.
Yeah, it's a wonderful point, because that debate in here is still reflected as you said, that debate here is still reflected in our world today. So would we say that a drug, let's say, that has non-conclusive studies today, we shouldn't even bother with that drug, right?
It depends if it's harmful.
Oh, well, okay, so if we've said that it's a sam mavet, right, that's why I read you this, if we know that it's harmful, then we say that's not a sam. We call it a sam mavet, we set it aside.
And that's the death one.
That's going to lead to death. But if something's not totally proven and I want to administer it, your point's well taken that even today we have those questions, and we would say, yes, give it. Not only that, the Gemara is going to now turn and say, and you might be doing some fancy calculus. How maybe if I don't do it this Shabbat, but I only do it for one Shabbat, it's going to be better, so right now I'm going to make them suffer for 25 hours, and then I'll start it on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. Right? You're going to see now they're going to deal with that question. Let's go inside. 84b1 on the right side, where it says the Mishnah stated. The right-hand column. Mifnei shesfek nefashotu. We place the medicine in someone's mouth because of this principle, where there's a possible danger to life, we break the laws. Lama li tu lameimar v'chol sfek nefashot tochayas haShabbat. Why do I need the Mishnah to say further, and every possible danger to life supersedes the Sabbath? In other words, the Mishnah said already that we treat the patient on Shabbat. Okay? So why does it emphasize we break the Sabbath? Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Lo Sefek Shabbat Zo Bilvad Amru. It doesn't just say that one may desecrate the Sabbath to save someone's life. Not only, here's what it, they like this, Lo Sefek Shabbat Zo Bilvad Amru. Not only for the saving his life on this Shabbat, in other words, on that Shabbat that you identify as the Shabbat that I need to save his life on, Ela afilu sfek Shabbat acheret, but on any Shabbat otherwise that I feel will help in the process of saving his life, right? I can only, if I'm literal, I say, I can break this Shabbat to save his life. But you're telling me on this Shabbat before that one, the eighth day of a drug, where I know I have to administer the eighth day of the drug, or what have you, that I can break this one too, as at only the beginning of the process of the dosage, the Gemara is going to come now and say, yeah, this one too. Heichidami, what's the case here? Heichidami is kind of, what's the case? Kagon de amaduha litmanya yayme viyema kama shabda, such as when the doctors assess the patient as requiring treatment for 8 days and the first day is a Shabbat. Mahu de tema leakav ad laorta? What would you say? Said in their English, you might have said this. No. What would you say? You have to kind of, you know, give the... What would you say? That we should wait till the evening to start the drug. So that we don't desecrate the two Sabbaths on account of the guy. Kamashmala. So you have the teaching. Want to know why it says first you treat him in the Mishnah? And then it says, and anything that's life-saving, you set aside the regulations for Shabbat? Because you might have said to me, 8 days of medication, and since I can violate one Sabbath, I'll wait till tonight to start the whole dosage. We say any Shabbat, this one and that one. You do whatever it takes to make sure you save the life. Gemara cites a brayta in support of the ruling. Now, this is probably to answer some of what culturally the rabbis are teaching, and that is, at all costs, make sure you observe the Sabbath. You must at all costs observe the Sabbath. Right? That was their message, that is their message on the whole. You must at all costs observe Yom Kippur. So the rabbis are going to work this time a couple of times in a couple of different directions to make sure you know, though, that A, these human needs come first, and B, don't worry if it's this Shabbat and next Shabbat, and it's a string of Shabbatot. You're gonna get nervous that you're breaking it so often. Don't get nervous. If you have to do this for saving lives, you do this for saving lives. Tanya Namihachi, it's taught in the Braita. Mechamin chamin lechole b'Shabbat. We heat water for a sick person on the Sabbath. Bein lahashkoto, bein lahavroto. Either to give him to drink or to bathe him and strengthen him. Below Shabbat zo bilvad amru, and not only that one Shabbat that you've identified as needing to do it. Ela l'Shabbat acheret, also for another Sabbath. Make sure you do it for this one and for that one. The ein omrim namtin lo shema yavri, and we don't say, you know what? Maybe we should wait it out, and after the Sabbath he'll get a little bit better. Ela machamin lo miyad, rather you make sure you heat up the water and you do it for him immediately. Because any possible danger to life supersedes the Sabbath. You may break Sabbath regulations, rules for that person. And not only for this particular Shabbat, and not just for this one, but for that one too. Make sure you break the Sabbath rules. And don't tell me you're going to go hire a bunch of Gentiles to come do the work for you. V'lo al yedei chutim. And don't tell me you're going to bring the Samaritan workforce into the picture. I'll tell you about the Kuthians in a minute. Eila al yedei gedolei Yisrael. Rather, you should do it. The adults, the Jewish adults, should do it. The Jewish men. Here's what you tell me. Really, did it have to go here? Ve'ein omrim ye'asu devarim halalu lo al pi nashim. However, we do not say that these things should be done on the assessment of women. Ve'lo al pi chutim, or on the assessment of kutians. Aval mitzarfin l'da'at acheret. But they do combine with another person to make the decision that it must be done. Now.
The assessment or the task?
No, the assessment.
The assessment is the assessment.
That means making the judgment.
To making the judgment.
They are putting more people into the pool of the decision making.
So why does it exclude women, you ask, in terms of making the decision, when we had all the discussion about women before who seemed to be right in there about making the assessments of the sick and what have you? Not clear. Could it be that, in general, they were seen as not having the experience and not having, at that point, the kind of exposure to these things? Fine. Could it be that they wanted to protect her in some way? You want to read this generously and say that it's a matter of protection and they don't want a woman to be in the decisor kind of role, and then somebody would worry if he died and there was some issue that she had said the wrong thing and there'd be a question of the ketubah. You could just see the whole Megillah unfold, right? So you have to look at it in any number of different ways. You have to wonder aloud if there are, kind of different ways to see the text unfold. We already had said up above, don't do the job through the Kuthians or the Kuthians or Kuthians, and you can't have them make the assessment either. Just a note on these kinds of things. The Kuthians, it says in note 15, listen to this, converted to Judaism after an outbreak of attacks by wild animals in the part of Eretz Yisrael that is considered today Samaria, like as in Yehuda Shomron. Tanaim disagree as to whether their conversion was valid. But what's the backstory? Just so since we'll see them in our passages, let me give you the backstory quickly of the Kuthians or Kuthians or Kutim. So generally we understand them to be the Samaritans. Okay, the Samaritans, this is a group. Let's take one direction. Traditionally, this is how we explain who they are. The Assyrians come and they conquer the northern kingdom, right? Let's come back to our history in the days of the Bible. So if you recall, what year is this? 722.
BCE.
When this happens, as was the practice of the Assyrian Empire, the Jewish people are basically
moved out.
Others are moved in. This was the way.
Or the king or the people to lend to work the land so he can get the money out.
Okay, could be that. There's also population shift. The king did that so that he would still have tribute and get any resources. But the idea too was that he was mixing people up so that they wouldn't have any kind of sense of nationalism in their heritage spot. This was an idea of empire building. They were brought there. They're brought in with their own set of kind of realities of who they are and what they are. We pretty much know that they came from an ancient city called Kuta, which is in Iraq, that they worshipped the god Nergal, and that they were basically idol worshippers. Except to say, tradition goes from our Gemara, there's some kind of episode in the Book of Kings where they are immediately converted or kind of come under the notion that they are now monotheistic. They are, for all intents and purposes, Eze min Yehudi. They are a type of Jew. And they settle in that Samaria region, and they're there for a long time, actually. And they might have even politicked with Ahasuerus during the Persian Empire, since it's Adar and Purim's coming, we have to bring in the story where we can. They might have even wheeled and dealed and said to Ahasuerus, these Jews, all they want to do is undermine you, don't let them come back, because there had to be some thinking about whether Jews could leave those areas and come back to their land and build a temple before Cyrus the Great allows that to happen, right? There needs to be some discussion. Well, the tradition is that the Samaritans convinced Ahasuerus to not allow the Jews to return to land because they were interested in maintaining now the control that they had since the time that the Assyrians brought them there. There's another little twist in the whole historical episode of who these Kutians really are, and it, you know, were they Assyrian? Or, really there are two twists, were they a group really under the Babylonian kind of kingdom who lived in this place called Kuta, and that was Iraq, and were they a group that seized on the opportunity of the early Babylonian conquests to come into the land and created their own kind of place and space in the land. And then, for whatever the reality of culture left in the region, even though some had been removed from Assyria, you had certain tribes who were left and certain Jewish practices that were still around, and they became monotheistic and more Jewish-oriented than they were allied and connected with their ancient god, Nergal. Still leading them to grow and leading them to have their own ritual practices that look like the Jewish ritual practices. They remain in the land even after Cyrus brings them back. Now, I said there was two alternatives, the Babylonian one we just did. The third one is that they lived in that Kuta, but they were from the lost tribes, some dispersed Jewish peoples of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Levi, and that they were actually out there and then kind of made their way back to the land when there was an opportunity, whether that was during Assyrian times or Babylonian times, not exactly sure. Either which way, Jewish roots, more than just converting, Book of Kings, we don't really know, again. But what we do know is that the rabbis, they relate to them in the Talmud, and they're a group who are around, and we now have this encounter not only, you know, with this group and that group and this group, early Christians are coming onto the scene, meaning the heretics are generally the words we use for them, and there are other groups who have been named in various passages throughout the Mishnah, people who you can relate with, cannot relate to, do business with, not do business with because of their idol worship and their practices, and we're learning that now in Daf Yomi, in Masechet Avodah Zarah, in the idol worship tractate. Long story short, the rabbis are pretty suspect of the Kutians by the time the Talmud and the Talmudic period comes on the scene, because they realize, or they want to claim, that they are really returning to idol worship. They are not true to roots Jews as we know them. And let's say that there was a group who was more idol worship oriented of Kutians, and the Shomronim, which is the name we gave to the small community that's going to survive Ad Hayom Hazeh, till this very day in Israel.
They live in Holon.
And use Mount Gerizim, right?
Mount Gerizim.
That Ad Hayom Hazeh, till this day, they still are around. And so we call those the Samaritans, the Shomronim, and that's all this group that's being discussed in our passages in the Talmud. So that's the quick background. The rabbis are somewhat interested, by the way, in bringing anyone into the fold that they possibly can to accept their authority, the authority of Torah as they see it, the Midrash as they see it, Shabbat laws as they see it, all of this. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have some interaction among and with this group in our passages of the Talmud. They obviously are living close to one another. Obviously are living close to one another, because as the passages will reveal, they have rubble falling on their heads together. Okay. We just did, where were we? Yeah. We just did 84B1, right?
B2.
Right. All right, not the Gentiles. A related brayta comes along. 84B2, last two lines on the left side. Tanu Rabbanan. Mifakhin pikuach nefesh b'Shabbat. We tend to matters involving danger of life on the Sabbath. So now we've said our two principles, Steik nefeshot la'akel and pikuach nefesh tochev ha'Shabbat. Said them and affirm them again. V'hazariz haray ze mishubach. And if you thought that you had to sit and ask the question, should I do this, should I not do this? Or you had to, by the way, run to the court to get sanctioned and made a deputy because the court gave you permission, lest you think like that, here's a brayta for you. Ve'ein tzarich litol rashut mibeitin. You don't need to go obtain authorization from the court. Ha ketzad. How so? Really? I don't need authorization? Ra'ati nok shenafal hayam. If you see that a child fell into the sea, pores mitzuda uma alehu. You spread a net and you bring him up. So either you have it because you live near there and it is yours and you use it, and even if it's the thing you use for professional fishing, you use that net, or if it's laying around and you're out near the sea, you cast that net. V'hazariz hareze mishubach. And one who's quick to do so, that's praiseworthy. V'ein tzarich litol reshut mibeitin. And you don't need to go get permission from the beitin to break the Sabbath. Gemara further says, doubles down, v'af agav dekat sayed kavre. And this is permitted even if he traps fish together with the child. Revealing what? Revealing that, first of all, trapping is one of the malachot, right? Collecting those fish. Revealing that, A, there's somebody out there worried that I better not touch my net. But then the Gemara comes and says, and it says it like this in another place, and didn't say it here. It's being very nice in the Yom Kippur tractate. It says, you're a chassid tipshi. You're a stupid, pious fool. If you have a second thought about that net. Now what it's trying to protect against, obviously, is this notion of being so concerned with the Sabbath law that you would miss the opportunity, not only for the child. I think this is not only for the child. I think this brayta is presenting an attitude. It's presenting an outlook. Because like the whole net and the fish and the business and the kids drowning, right? If anyone has the chance that he's going to drown, you throw the net and you don't worry about what else comes out with it. It speaks to us, because who's going to really stop themselves and say, I had better think before I, who knows what. Grab my tools to shut off the water that seems to, you know, if I know how to do it, because there's a flood going on in my building, right? And I could leak it through the, who's going to think twice about grabbing that tool, right? I don't think that we would necessarily be stopped in our tracks about such a thing. Then take a life, even the more so. Am I going to really be concerned that, let's say there's a possibility of tearing someone's garment, God forbid they, who knows what, they're going to fall somewhere, and I'm so worried that I'm going to rip their something, and I think about that instead of reaching out and grabbing them away from the street. Some car is speeding across. Or something stops me from doing it. Or, by the way, if they're a Jew versus a non-Jew. We may not be in that space, either ethically or Shabbat consciously. But there are communities in which this becomes a reality. And so nervous are people about breaking Sabbath law that you may or may not have people trying to make the kind of calculus that we saw with the 8 days of medicine or the kind of life-saving reality that we're seeing here. How about a guy who's a medic who rides one of the ambulettes that's a motorbike on Shabbat, who's, you know, completely decked out, kippah, peyot, the whole deal. Well, they have all kinds of classes about how to navigate all of, quote-unquote, breaking the Shabbat laws that they need to in order to be the life-saving paramedics and medics that they can be. But they do it according to the notion of the pikuach nefesh. But what about a person who has a little bit of medic training in the army, right? And now who's even in, like, kippah surgah, or is modern Orthodox, and you had a little bit of medic training because you rode the ambulance in Tinek when you were a kid, and you really have a Shabbat conscience, but you could really do something, like cut some bandages and apply them, right? It's trying to create an environment where there's not a second thought. If I need to help with alleviating pain to actually saving a life.
This doesn't deal with a kind of corollary, which is the risk of life.
Ah, but now we're going to get into that.
Okay.
And that's a good kind of, what you've noticed so far is that it seems not to have a lot of risk here, right? Throw a net, cast it in, do you jump in after him? It didn't deal with that here, right? It didn't comment. I think part of what's going to happen in the discussions is that you're going to see a little bit of they're going to up the ante on risk, which is why maybe they're going to make some distinctions among the people. With our homes and with our belongings and this and that, maybe they know exactly what was in it. Maybe they don't know what's in the other piles of rubble. Maybe the risk factor is what's coming to play in the mapolet, in the rubble that falls from the sky. Maybe there's be some other discussion that touches on risk that you'll be able to tease out. So see if it satisfies you. Just the Gemara resumes its citation of the Braita that we're in, second column on 84b2. Ra'ati nokshe nafal lebor. If I saw a child that fell into a pit, oker chulia umalehu, he removes part of the rim surrounding the pit and brings the child up. V'hazariz harei ze meshubach. I might worry that I put a track in the earth. I might worry that there's some kind of forbidden labor that I'm going to do to break the rim this way or that way. I don't worry about it. Ve'ein tzarich litol reshut mibeitin, and he's not going to go get permission from any beitin. The Gemara interjects, af al gav demitaken darga, this is permitted even though he makes a step for use on the after the Sabbath. By the way, if you left it there and you made a fix and it seems to be in a new place and that step is going to be used now, don't worry about it. Ra'ashenin ala delet bifnei tinok, if one saw that a door locked shut before a child. A child was locked in a room. Shovra umotzio. You may break the door down and take the child out. This happens. You're in a house. You have 13 children in the house. Okay? The back bathroom on the merpeset is just built because it comes in stages. Every little bit of the house. Only when you get the money. The shekels. You build the bathroom. There's a key to the lock of the bathroom, inside the bathroom. The little child goes into the bathroom, shuts the door, turns the key, throws the key into the toilet. I'm not making this up. You can't make this up. So where's the key, Yosef Chaim? Where's the key? Yosela, where's the key? It's in the potty. So they got tools. They used a crowbar. They broke the door, And they did everything necessary to get Yosef Chaim out of the bathroom.
I would give him that.
Such humanity comes out of the Gemara and the study of Talmud. Oh, see? No! You can't leave him in there all day long. You can only do it for half a day. Oh, that's funny. Okay, so the Gemara interjects, and this is permitted even though he's going to intend to break it to pieces. V'af al gav deka michayvin lemit bar b'shife. So you can break it into pieces. Michavin u'mafsikin mivnei at the lake of a Shabbat. We may extinguish or block the progress of a fire on Shabbat. This is where I'm thinking that there's some degree of risk involved. Right? Fighting fires in the ancient world is very different than fighting fires in our time. Still dangerous. Very different, though, then. Right? The Hazar Riz Harreze Mishubach. One who is quick to do so is praiseworthy. Ve'ein tzarich lipol reshut mibeitin. And you see, like, people are worried. Do I get permission from the Beitin? Ve'af al gav deka mimakei chumakuchei. And this is permitted even though he flattens out the coals in order to cook over them in the evening. Ah! Since we had a fire and I had some coals there, why not use the heat energy? No, that was from the fire on Shabbat. Go ahead. We can go out and use it. The Gemara explains why the Braita mentions each case. So it's going to get into a little bit of a discussion. I want to skip over some of the details here, but I'll just tell you outside the text for a minute and move over to the right-hand column. It's going to give you a principle where the child and these people who are in, you know, kind of a perilous situation, because they are of your ilk and because they are your family and because they are known quantities, you can take care of business. But if you didn't know, the Gemara is going to kind of philosophize, if you didn't know exactly who was there, could you do the same thing? What if they were Kutians? That's going to be the kind of question that the Gemara is going to take us into. Go to the right-hand side. Gemara cites an Amoraic ruling. Amar Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav Shmuel. Rav Yosef says in the name of Rav Yehuda, says in the name of Shmuel. Lo halachu b'fikuach nefesh achar harov. The sages did not follow the majority where saving a life is concerned. That is, they rule in favor of saving a life even where this opposes the law of following the majority. Thus, if a person's life is in danger and we do not know whether he is a Jew or an idolater, we desecrate the Shabbat on his behalf even if it is more likely that he is an idolater. So it's going to come to the conclusion that we want to break the Sabbath law and we absolutely don't go by the, you know, whether or not there are 6 Jews and 4 idolaters. We basically have 2 directions that we can go to make sure we make every effort we can to save them, and that is, I can either say, I assume that there's an equal number in there, and therefore I'm permitted, or I simply negate going by any ruling of the majority at all, and I say, I know that they were in that place, and since they were in that place, and I know who's there, I'm going in after them. And so that's the discussion that's going to ensue. 84b4, and then go to 84b4 on the right side. The Gemara notes a contradiction between Shmuel's ruling in this case and another one of his rulings. Umi amar Shmuel haki. Now did Shmuel actually say this, namely that we do not follow the law of majority where saving a life is concerned? V'hatanan, but we have learned in the Mishnah regarding a city inhabited by both Jews and Kutians. Matzah batinok mushlach. If one found an abandoned child in the city, and we don't know whether he's a Jew or a Kutain, his identity is determined as follows. Im rov Kutim Kuti. If a majority of the city's inhabitants are Kutians, he's treated as a Kutian. Ve'im rov Yisrael Yisrael. And if a majority of the inhabitants are Jews, he's treated as a Jew. Mechetza al Mechetza Yisrael. If half of the inhabitants are Jews and half are Kutians, he's treated as a Jew. Ve'amar Rav. And Rav says, in reference to the Mishnah, Lo shanu eil l'hachayoto. They taught that if most of the city's inhabitants are Jews, the child is treated as a Jew only with respect to sustaining him, aval le'ahasolo, but not with respect to ascribing pure lineage to him. So, to say that we have exceptions, if you will, or no concern at all by way of making sure we save someone's life, yes, we go in and we save a life. But when it comes to pure lineage or questions of lineage, we've got to go through and we've got to understand ala Masechet Kiddushin, some of the other places in the Mishnah, some of the other places in the Gemara, really what lineage is this person and are they okay to marry in and marry this one and marry that one? We still have lots of questions about status that way. So when we say that you should go and save this life because you thought we might have only saved a life that's, quote-unquote, got status in our civil courts, no, you save lives. But you still have the notion of making some distinction. And peoples have distinctions that they have to make. And we have distinctions in terms of the who and the what when it comes to lineage and marriage and who's in and who's out when it comes to some of these business dealings and the like.
So clear to me, though, is this seems to be talking about the situation where we don't know what someone's background is. I haven't seen where it says you save a life even if you know the person from idolatry.
Well, by saying Kutian,
right.
My suggestion is that, and generally accepted, that they are using the term as the idolaters who are kind of living around you. And I think it's more like this. It's kind of like the idolaters who you tolerate.
Right, but this doesn't seem to get at the question of what happens if you know that the person is a Kutian.
Well, yeah, and so we're going to get a little bit more there.
Okay.
I think.
It's a big problem. I can tell you right now.
So before we go on, it's still bothering me because obviously the Kutians are not respected and have a low status. And yet the women were included with the Kutians in terms of not being able to make an assessment. So I don't really see how you give women, this seems to be a really low opinion of women.
Yeah, I mean, I think by way of saying aloud and plainly, we wish it didn't go there. I think that you could say that's a difficult text. That's what we call the...
If you're a woman, it's a difficult text, yes.
I mean, I think for everybody.
I mean, it's...
I think it's a difficult text for us, too.
There's loopholes here and loopholes there, and there's, you know, kind of provisions and things like that.
I'm agreeing with you that
it doesn't seem to
but
have anything
I think we call this in scholarship a difficult text. It's really, truly not the way we would opine today if you're talking about an ethic that includes women who can make assessments, whether or not it's
like 200 CE?
Well, you could say that was in a Brita, so you're talking about anywhere between 1 BCE and 2 CE. So you're talking about that amount of time. Status of women in the law is very different, right? And what I suggested, without trying to be apologetic about it, is that A, doesn't sit well because we would expect, of course, and wish that all the way back then, and it's just not the reality, women had a different kind of experience in life and that they could have learned and been experts and been exposed to these things and been trusted by way of status in the court, etc., but they were not. And so that's very plain. And so we see expressions of that, and we have to call them out for what they are, expressions of that. Two, was there, and am I allowed to ask, was there a reason why I'm protective of a woman making an assessment if someone should need Shabbat violated for him? The only kind of suggestion I made tonight in that regard, and this is kind of an Occam's razor question, how far can I kind of spin this to be making up the situation where it just becomes erroneous or ridiculous. But you can also ask those questions about motivations. And was there any kind of potential that she would have, in the case of his death, some type of struggle with the family of the man in terms of her ketubah and what was due to her rightfully, based on other contracts that did protect some of her rights. And since we're talking about pikuach nefesh, and we're talking in the realm of trying to make sure that we save a life, but sometimes we know we don't save a life, that's the only worry that I have. We don't want non-Jews to make those assessments, and we for sure don't want his wife to be stuck with that. So it's the only generous read I can make of it that I thought about.
I had no suspicion that this decision was made by the wife, that the woman would be the wife necessarily.
That's the suspicion that I had.
I don't know if it's changed that much with the Satmar community today or the real Hasidic community in Israel with respect to women. I would probably say that it's probably the same.
Exactly.
I don't know technically.
I don't think that if they've been very much, any of the books that come out now from some of the women that have left the community, it seems exactly like it was at the time of the Talmud.
Could be. It very well could be. I don't know the internal goings-on of, say, Satmar determinations on Shabbat as to whether or not someone's going to get medical attention. I do know one woman who had, you jogged my memory of a woman I once spoke with who definitely had disagreements with her husband about how they should or should not treat a child medically
on Shabbat.
And not to say that we are Scientologists or believe in no treatment at all, but again, this concern that I've pointed out tonight around these texts, that they are concerned that people run to the Beit Din for permission to do this and have to run to the Rebbe to figure out if they can do this, I think is at the core acknowledgement of not only our Satmar community today or other, and not to just say Satmarim, there are communities where that might be really a mode of operation where it wants to encourage a much more lenient outlook. And so if you know the law well enough, this Gemara is suggesting, I would say, you can really be lenient. It's not letting you off the hook for the other Shabbatot of the year. It's for sure respecting the Sabbath in all its glory, but it wants you very much to consider yourself a rescue, a search and rescue, a medic on the scene, and make the decisions and go for it.
Do you know if this chapter was written in Babylon or in Israel? Because I think they are using the word kutim on purpose of goyim. Because kutim is half Jew, let's put it in, so it's like our semi-brothers. Hmm. And they don't want to go to the argument of non-Jewish because if they know that the guy is not Jewish, like we are not going to help them extinguish a fire on Shabbat.
Here, I'll take that as homework.
Well,
here's where we'll leave the night. My homework will be to look at the manuscripts and see if there is another manuscript that uses goyim, A, and think about your question as to whether or not this is code for just non-Jews. May Luisa Paulino have a refuah shlema, refuah nefesh, refuah haguf. May our learning tonight, in her honor, really bring her and her family the inspiration necessary in order to overcome any and all travails and challenges that she's experiencing. Amen.
Thank you.